is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 44th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am super pleased to have with me today Steve Kent. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Gary.
Steve Kent is Chief Scientist for Information Security of BBN Technology, a division of Raytheon, where he's been engaged in network security research and development for several decades. Dr. Kent is a well-known security researcher whose work ranges from end-to-end encryption and access control systems for packet networks through design of secure transport layer and electronic message protocols to performance analysis of security mechanisms. Steve once chaired the Internet Privacy and Security Research Group and was a member of the Internet Activities Board, or IAB. He now chairs the PKICS for IETF. Steve has a BS from Loyola in mathematics and an SMEE and PhD in computer science from MIT. Steve is also quite the wine connoisseur, so hopefully we'll get some advice about that later on. You've been at one place for a very long time, Steve. The BBN.
Yes, it's a dead-end job. But
a good dead-end job. It's sort of the BBN catbird seat, perhaps. So, and you've been there during the evolution from, say, NCP all the way to Web 2.0.
Yes, it's been fun to see how the Internet has changed, certainly in the early days. We had no idea whatsoever that this would become such a pervasive technology. I knew that things had changed when I started pulling corks out of wine bottles, and instead of seeing a toll-free number to contact a winery, I started seeing a URL.
That's quite the change. So what's it been like to work on internet security for so long?
Well, it's certainly been a learning experience, I think, for me and for many of the other folks who you've talked to in this series, as we've seen the environment evolve considerably. The problems we were trying to solve in the early days, in the latter part of the 70s and into the early 80s, let's say, are much, much simpler conceptually than the challenges we face today. And we had trouble, even back in the simpler times, in getting suitable mechanisms developed, engineered, and tremendous difficulty trying to deploy them. Mm-hmm. So that part has remained constant, unfortunately, but the challenges have grown immensely.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the notion of secure transport is not exactly a new one. And yet, even in the base protocols these days, we're still having trouble getting adoption.
Yes, I'm proud in some respects of the kind of work that I was part of many years ago, because we did a lot of this stuff in the early days. We did it under funding from DARPA, typically. Mm-hmm. Back in the early days at BBN, I was working on end-to-end encryption as an overlay, as something you could slip in between IP and the TCP layers, much the way we do with IPsec today. Mm-hmm. And we had hardware to do this, had the first DES chips that were ever certified by what was then the NBS, now NIST, and a system with key distribution centers and access controllers. And I wrapped up performance measurements on that project in my first full year at BBN as an employee, several years before Project Athena at MIT started and Kerberos came along.
So, right.
in those days, we were doing really cutting-edge stuff, and yet we couldn't get it out into the mainstream, which has always been a disappointment.
So I guess that leads to my next question, which you can dodge if you want. What role has politics played in accelerating or slowing down real security on the Internet?
Oh, I think in various ways politics does enter into that, as it intrudes on all the aspects of our lives. Mm-hmm. Certainly the export control regimens that were in place, not only in the United States, but through a collection of countries, Western European as well as U.S., et cetera, mm-hmm. in the 80s and into the first part of the 90s did have real effects on what we did. It had effects on the standards that we were developing in the ITF at the time. Mm-hmm. And it impeded the progress, the deployment of the technology. However, we've seen all those sort of Cold War era controls diminished very, very dramatically. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't caused encryption to become a normal part of all the stuff that we do, with the exception of people using TLS or SSL for protecting credit card numbers as they sent across the internet, mm-hmm. which of course is the time when they're probably the least vulnerable to the threat you should be worrying about. I mean, they're in danger when they get to the other end.
Exactly. And you know, the risk management aspects of credit card stuff are almost all back end, and yet we spend all this worrying about the transport level for that stuff.
It's right. I think what happened there was that the technology was applied at the one place in the system where it was easiest to deploy, mm-hmm. through browsers and by selling server certificates to people, to give a perception to the consumer of security so that they'd be more comfortable doing online purchases, online banking, etc. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been reasonably successful as a perception band-aid, but as you certainly know, and you've told your readers about, this is not getting at the area where the real problems exist. That's a lot harder. So it's unfortunate, but true.
So do you think that the diminishing influence of the Cold War export controls, now that they're gone, I mean, what is holding IPsec back? I mean, even the last two or three years, there seemed to be kind of a new groundswell, and then it disappeared.
Well, IPsec, and of course I have an emotional attachment to it as the principal author of those standards. The good news is that it's very widely available because it ships in every operating system out there and has for several years. Mm-hmm. The bad news is people almost never turn it on.
Right.
And I think there are several very legitimate reasons for that. One of them is that IPsec, unlike TLS, isn't just a protocol that provides you with confidentiality and integrity and authentication. It provides access control. That's mm-hmm. a fundamental feature of it. And access control requires management, and doing that management well requires discipline, and users are short on discipline.
There you go. So it's a human nature problem, kind of.
It's a human nature problem in terms of home use, let's say. And in a corporate environment, my perception is that still today, despite what we know, most corporate IT security folks believe and focus heavily on perimeter security, firewalls, IDS, etc. Mm-hmm. And so the notion of encrypting traffic internally within their network strikes them as a lot of work and not worth the benefit in terms of countering any perceived threats. Even though, of course, it's not just encrypting the traffic, it's providing that access control, which would help prevent the spread of malware under the right management controls. Mm-hmm. So it's similar in some regards to the use of secure email, S/MIME.
Yep.
When we did the early work for privacy-enhanced mail at the end of the 80s and into the early 90s, we took us a while, but we did a reasonable job of working our way through the technical issues. And what we didn't really appreciate in terms of a barrier to deployment was the fact that if you issued certificates to people, you had to make them available to other folks in order to allow encrypted, not just digitally signed messages, mm-hmm. to flow freely. And that directory problem of making that information available prevented widespread deployment because organizations did not want to have those directories externally available to the rest of the world,
right.
because of spam,
right.
and because of providing tremendous inputs to headhunters. And so those sorts of things that are part of the overall system for deployment and success tend to be significant roadblocks. And IPsec encounters some of that. S/MIME has certainly encountered that.
Yep.
It's been an issue.
There's a new barrier for S/MIME, by the way, because Thought disappeared last month. And now if you want to get a certificate, you got to buy one from VeriSign.
Well, you can make up your own certificates.
Well, yeah, there's the
It's all a question of who you want to talk to and how you're going to bootstrap. But you're right, the folks at VeriSign have essentially cornered the market, tremendous amount of mind share there, even though you can go to GoDaddy and get a certificate for your website for not much more than you're paying for your website.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it's the thing that we've missed as a tremendous opportunity is to tie certificates into domain name system management.
Yep. I agree with that completely.
If we had just done that, it would be a distributed system. We wouldn't have a monopoly player in the marketplace, I believe. And because most of what we want in the way of certificates are ones that, on an everyday basis, are in fact tied to those domain names, it would be an ideal matchup. Mm-hmm. But we didn't do that.
Alas.
Yes.
So when you began your work in Internet and Applied Security in 1978, I guess you were an intern back then. Did you anticipate making a career out of it?
Well, the way I got involved is I showed up at MIT in the fall of 74 as a graduate student, and I wanted to do operating system stuff. And I wound up being connected with the research group at what was then Project Mac that did that, historically, the Multics group.
Mm-hmm.
And the Multics group, although I hadn't realized at the time, was very heavily focused on operating system security issues. So, well, while I was attached to that group, I began to look for a master's thesis topic. And the head of that group, Jerry Salzer, pointed me to the work that was happening at that time frame, the early days of cryptography coming out from behind the door and appearing in the public literature, the IBM work on Lucifer, the call for the development of a data encryption standard before the specific algorithm was chosen that became mm-hmm. DES.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, gee, people are saying that as soon as this becomes public and we have a standard, people will make chips and this will solve a whole bunch of problems. And he suggested that he thought there might be a little more to it than that. And that there would be a thesis topic lurking in there.
You think? Just one?
And I said, okay, boss, sure. And so I started looking into the area and published my master's thesis a couple of years later, which was the first, to the best of my knowledge, the first public treatment of the issue of how to integrate crypto into protocols in very simple environments, and explored lots of the issues that I went into in more detail in later work in the 80s and 90s.
So you just never got done with your thesis is the real answer.
I never did what I thought I was setting out to do, but the things that I've done instead have all turned out to be enjoyable and exciting and certainly a learning experience.
So I want to talk about applied cryptography a little bit more, because we all know it can be difficult and really challenging to do properly. And we talked about the commercial space a bit, but I wondered if you could talk about the major differences in fielding reasonable crypto in a military setting versus a corporate setting.
Well, there are a lot of big differences. Historically, the military, whether it's U.S. or others, have relied upon hardware crypto. And even today, that's the major focus if you're serious about protecting classified information. And the motivation for that is that you can have confidence if you build a box and engineer it very carefully and vet it very thoroughly, that it's going to do what you thought it was going to do. And you don't have to worry about all the software on somebody's server or their laptop or desktop machine undermining your confidence in the crypto doing its job properly. And the commercial sector, to the extent that it does cryptography, with a few exceptions, focuses almost exclusively on software-based crypto.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that there's an enormous difference in terms of the assurance that you can have that the crypto you're using is doing what you expect it to do, is not being bypassed, etc. Now, there are exceptions. The folks at NIST have done a fabulous job, in my opinion, with the FIPS 140 series of evaluation criteria for crypto modules, which can apply to both software and hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And certain sectors of industry do emphasize the use of FIPS evaluated hardware modules, and I think that's been a very successful program. I've been able to learn about how well it works when I've served as an external reviewer for the security lab at NIST on a few occasions over the years, and they have great statistics showing that of the products that are brought to them for review, and presumably a company that is bringing the products to a laboratory that has been certified by NIST to do this review, that they think they're going to pass because otherwise you're wasting your money and time, that a very high percentage of those products have security significant errors in the documentation associated with the product. And even if you, I guess if you never think anyone reads the user's manual, it's not quite so big a deal, but still, it's worrisome. And a significant percentage, tens of percents, maybe 30, 40%, have security flaws that are detected in the course of the evaluation procedure and thus are remedied before they get the seal of approval.
Right.
And that's, those are all products that would have been out on the market touting that they provided good security when in fact they didn't.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that shows that that kind of evaluation program, which is not unreasonably onerous, I mean, one of the things that we did at BBN in the 90s was to build a crypto module specifically for use with public key certification authorities, and it was the first module evaluated under FIPS 140-1 Level 3. And, you know, one, it was a little difficult being a pioneer, getting the arrows, but it didn't cost a arm and a leg. It was reasonable for what we were doing. And even in our stuff, they found some bugs, which we were able to remedy very quickly and easily, but it was an excellent process. So I think that's one of the few examples that we can point to in the security community of a product evaluation process that has been extremely successful. It's not overly long. It's not unduly expensive or burdensome. And the results are very, very good.
So one might argue that that's because of the limited nature of the target of evaluation. And when it comes to modern software like these ridiculously massive distributed systems we're building, that even the same very reasonable approach just doesn't scale. And that's the challenge. That's the challenge we all face when it comes to trying to make software work, for example.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree, Gary, that it's successful because it has modest, though important, goals, well-defined boundaries, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And an individual operating system, even on my laptop, is so dramatically more complex that it's qualitatively different, not just quantitatively different. And then when you expand that, as you were saying, to distributed system environments, we don't really know what we're doing. And so trying to achieve a reasonable level of assurance in those environments is a tremendous challenge, and we're not up to it yet.
We'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Gary McGraw, host of the Reality Check podcast with Gary McGraw. This podcast series is focused on practical questions centered on running large-scale software security initiatives. Reality Check targets experienced leaders working to solve software security problems every day. Reality Check is sponsored by Sigital and syndicated by CSO Magazine. For more, see www.sigital.com/realitycheck. Let's talk about another aspect of a system that doesn't seem that complicated, but it's super critical, BGP, which has been lambasted for years as sort of the Achilles heel of the internet, you know, both via Black Hat prezos and the famous Loft claims regarding taking down the net in 30 minutes and so on. Are things getting any better? I know you worked on SBGP and PKI and attestation for BGP, and what's the deal?
Well, we are making real progress there, though it has been a very, very slow process. The SBGP work that we did not quite a decade ago was useful in terms of exploring what sorts of security assurances one could try to provide in that environment, and was guided by a very old principle, speaking of, you know, Jerry Salzer,
there you go,
Schroeder, et cetera, principle of least privilege, and saying, we have in the internet, nobody is in charge, and each autonomous system is being operated by an entity who takes that word autonomous very seriously. And so the best you can do is to say that when they make announcements about routes in the internet, that you can verify that the announcements they're making are ones that they have transitively been authorized to make. And that's about it. But we come nowhere close to it in today's system.
Yeah.
And that allows things like the Pakistan YouTube hijacking to occur.
Or so, I guess the BGP eavesdropping, which is something that I guess you anticipated far before the Black Hat guys.
Yeah, we had anticipated that would be an issue because for the BGP work, the SBGP work, we said, sure, you could do this. And at one point somebody said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, we could show you. And we did a very brief demo with part of our own address space just to show people that that could be done.
Mm-hmm.
The trickier part being not getting the traffic to come to you, but getting it to go through you and then to the real destination.
Exactly.
And
the pre-pending thing was very clever.
Yeah. So it's the kind of thing where if you have to convince somebody that you, by showing them, by doing an experiment, you do it, but we're not looking to point out vulnerabilities like that to the world in general. This is just trying to convince people that it's a serious problem and they should fund it. And so we presented to people and showed them it was a serious problem.
Yeah, I sort of have a question about that. Just your view of sharing ideas inside, say, the DOD and the, you know, national security establishment versus publicizing things, and what causes better security results in your decades of experience?
I think that's a tough one. I have some sympathy for researchers who have discovered vulnerabilities, bring them to the attention of vendors quietly, saying, hey, this is an issue and you really ought to fix it, and then become frustrated by what they see as complete inaction on the part of the vendors to fix the problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you get to that point, then the question is, well, gee, what do you do to try and make sure this is fixed? And I don't want to comment on the, is it appropriate to go public with this to force the hand of the vendor to do it? Should you be going to the CERT and trying to get them to enter the fray and put pressure on the vendor, et cetera? I rarely find myself in that position. I usually am looking at issues on behalf of government clients and saying, hey, there is a concern here and you guys really need to either tell the vendor that you're not going to buy more of this if they don't fix the problem, or you'll have to put in some remedial measure to deal with it because you can't get the vendor to fix it, or you know, it's just going to take too long or whatever. So I don't tend to find myself in those positions, and since I don't think it's fair for me to talk about what's the good or bad way to do this.
Well, you know, I think that's a very rational response, and frankly the one that almost all research guys, scientists like you are, have. So, you know, it's an important opinion for some of the other guys, the researchers, the so-called researchers, to have a view of, I think. Another question.
But getting back to the BGP stuff, the one thing I would like to say is that we are making very big progress in the following sense. We have gotten the ITF to establish a working group that is establishing standards for securing BGP, and in particular is focusing initially on creating a public key infrastructure that will issue certificates to the holders of address space throughout the worldwide internet. And of course, it's nice to have standards for this, but if the people who are responsible don't do it, then you're losing. And fortunately, all of the regional internet registries, all five of them around the world, and the IANA have all signed on to this. And in fact, they've published recently a declaration to say that they would have an operational capability by the beginning of 2011.
Oh, that's great.
Some of them are already doing this on a sort of prototype or testbed basis. Some of the regional registries are doing it. So it's taken a lot of work. And, of course, you're getting these people to put their resources to devote to this. So they have to believe it's a reasonable thing to do with the funds that their members, ISPs, give them. So that's encouraging. It's just going to be a first step. If people do this and if ISPs make use of the data, then the simple kinds of hijacks, which may be purely benign, but in terms of, you know, not malicious, even though they have terrible effects, could be prevented just by doing this first step. It doesn't deal with the more insidious kinds of prepending attacks, et cetera, we've talked about, but it would get rid of all of the, oh, I fat fingered this and that's why I'm sucking down all this traffic I shouldn't be. And if you can get rid of that, that does tend to emphasize that anything else that's still happening is more likely to be malicious, and that in itself is beneficial.
What are your feelings and thoughts about security and individual liberty? Because I know you testified in Congress on behalf of the NRC about ID systems and the challenges technically posed by those. But as a person who's thought about this very carefully and as a careful thinker, I'm interested in kind of, you know, how you come down on that issue.
Well, I think that people should have the ability to control when they're disclosing identity information in the various kinds of transactions in which they engage. We wind up having to demonstrate who we are a lot more today than we used to, let's say, pre-9/11.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact of life on a worldwide basis. I do a lot of travel, as you do, and so you just recognize that you have to do that. But mm-hmm. in the online environment, we need to give individuals appropriate controls, things that are understandable and manageable by them, to decide when they're really going to disclose identifying information, credit card numbers, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier in many cases for the consumers of the information, not the users as consumers, but the companies, the merchants, etc., to want to request all sorts of stuff that they don't really need.
Well, the marketing people love it. You know,
the marketing people love it, absolutely. The numerati love it, the data mining folks. But I think that the problem we face here is that we can come up with lots of technical means of doing it, but people have a natural tendency to go for what is most convenient and easiest for them to use, not surprisingly.
Right.
And we failed to provide controls that make it so easy for people to behave in privacy-preserving fashions that is so far the exception rather than the norm, that we lose personal privacy unnecessarily as a result.
Yeah, my view is that the Europeans are doing a better job with that. And in fact, a recent study we did about the European Software Security Initiatives versus U.S. shows a larger emphasis on privacy just because it's part of the culture over there.
Absolutely. European privacy controls are much more stringent than those in the U.S. U.S. is pretty good in terms of personal liability for electronic transactions than you are in many European contexts,
mm-hmm.
and certainly in the U.K. from what I've read. But on the privacy front, I agree with you entirely that the European Commission has done a much better job. People are more serious about it. Pay a lot of attention to it, which we don't tend to do over here.
So one listener asked me to ask, and I quote, "How do you stand the sheer awesomeness of knowing and working with the amazing Mudge?"
Well, it is, of course, a challenge since his office is right next to mine.
I'm not sure who that listener was.
Let's see. I would tell you what his email address is at bbn.com, but that would only invite spam.
Excellent answer.
Mudge has been a great guy to work with. I first met him when he was working at BBN in our IT organization, and I hated to see him leave to go off to do the startups, to do At Stake, Loft, etc.,
mm-hmm.
that he did for a while, only because I was selfish and would love to have just had him working with us during the time. But I'm happy that he's come back to BBN, and we get to do a lot of work together, as well as stuff that he is doing independently. And he's a fun guy to work with.
So all our listeners want to know that. This, what is the most expensive bottle of wine that you've ever enjoyed?
Well, gee, it's hard to say. My wife and I celebrate our 35th anniversary this year, and we were in Rome at La Pergola, the only Michelin three-star there.
Uh-huh.
And they have a 60,000 bottle cellar.
Wow.
And so for our anniversary dinner for us and a few friends, they did find a Barolo from 1974, the year
Incredible.
We were married,
yep.
Which I think set me back a few bucks. But since it was sort of a package deal, I don't know the exact price of that bottle.
That sounds good. Any more reasonably priced bottles you can recommend to us mere mortals?
Well, there's a lot of great wine out there these days. The overall quality levels have gone up tremendously during the time that I've been a serious wine drinker. It's unfortunate that the very, very good stuff tends to get such wide notice in the wine press that the prices go up rather dramatically. In the good old days, I remember being able to buy the Beaulieu Vineyards, George Latour Private Reserve, and Phelps Insignia and things like that at much nicer prices than today.
It's kind of like how long it takes for a naked host to be exploited when it pops on the net.
That's right. You can tell that you don't have an internet connection if you've been plugged in for 20 minutes and nobody's probed you. And,
it's more like 35
and say, hey, what's wrong here?
35 seconds now. Well, thanks, Steve. This has been great.
It's been great talking to you, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Inform IT. The September-October 2009 issue of IEEE S&P is a special issue on securing DNS. The issue also has looks at NSA's wiretapping behavior under the Warrantless Wiretapping Program. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.